Murder to Three Movie Podcast. This week we aim to talk about The Fantastic Mr. Fox. If you have not seen it, we will be discussing spoilers. There will be spoilers, so I'm warning you. Now it's time to bail if you haven't seen it. If you have seen it, join us. My name is Tom Chick. I am here today with Christian Minstoust.
It's pronounced Juan.
Can't read my writing. Christian Minstoust.
Feel free to fade the music sometime before the end of the podcast.
Is that too loud?
No, actually, can you turn it up? Like about...
Good that Lord.
That was the...
What a spoiler that theme was.
Was it really?
Yeah.
So we have Christian Minstowski and Kelly Wand.
It's pronounced Murawski, like heron.
Murawski.
It's not how it says here.
That's a girl's name, Murawski.
It's like heron.
All right. Okay. I know what that's a reference to. No one else in the audience does. But
I don't.
That's your M.O.
But I laughed anyway, out of courtesy.
It's pronounced M.O.
Kelly Wand, do you have any shtick for us? What's your tagline this week?
Was she a great big fat person?
All right, that's good. It's
no setup required.
I know, everybody knows that's a good one. Everybody knows that line. And how do you tie that into the Fantastic Mr. Fox, I'm wondering? Or do you? You just don't.
Well, Silence of the Lambs.
Aha!
Foxes are also animals.
Good. What's the
Latin... They try to be silent.
Okay, what's the Latin term for a lamb? Go.
E pluribus uriplobitris, Tom Chick.
Very good. Well done.
I had to Google that really quick.
That was fast. So, what did you guys think of having to see a cartoon this week? I don't know if you guys were like me. I had a hard time sort of mustering up any enthusiasm for this movie. I'm a huge Wes Anderson fan, but I just watching a Wes Anderson cartoon.
Yeah, a movie for 3-year-olds.
I mean, that's what I was expecting. Did you guys have problems mustering enthusiasm to go to this?
Yeah, tons. I didn't want to see this. I was really annoyed, actually, that we hadn't picked Armored, which until I found out it was PG-13.
Right. You'd rather go to a PG cartoon than a PG-13 action movie. I'm with you. Now, you know, this was PG because it had, cussing, by the way. I like the way they did their cussing.
Yeah.
And smoke. There was smoking.
Right. And blood.
And alcohol. And blood. That's right. That's right. Wow, yeah.
And deaths.
Cool. And death. That's right.
Tons of deaths. Huge body count. Great, great body count. More than Armored, I suspect.
Dingus, did you have trouble mustering any enthusiasm for this, or you were psyched?
He's a parent. He loves this stuff.
Okay.
Well, this is not something I would take my kid to. Of course, I don't.
What? You're kidding.
No, I'm not kidding. He's five. He's five. He just turned five a couple
days ago.
You
could have made this his first movie. This would have been an awesome first movie for a 5-year-old. I would have killed to see this at five.
There might be a reason why you don't have a 5-year-old. No, I'm not taking. I'm not taking him to a theater until it's. I've got really strong views about that. So yeah.
Wow.
And when I went, by the way, I went to a weekend matinee showing, jam packed full of chattering children, every one of whom I wanted to just smack on top of the head, not like in a malicious way, just like a, you know, sort of a pop on the top of the skull, not where it would hurt them, just where it would alarm them.
Isn't that why you became a big brother, so you could be fun little kids?
I just could not.
I just assumed that was the other ethnicities.
I just couldn't believe.
Oh,
I couldn't believe just how acceptable it was, not only for the kids to talk, but their parents to let them talk. So, Dingus, tip of the hat to you. I think you.
Yeah, it's always their parents I want to smack on the head. I don't blame their kids. The parents should know better. You should not bring a kid to a theater until I don't know when, but. You should really consider it very carefully.
And for the kids' benefit or for the rest of the audience's benefit? Or both?
For both. For both. I've said this before. I'm a real evangelist for going to the theater. I believe in it as an experience. I don't get to go that often because over the last 5 years, I haven't gotten to go that often because I've got a kid. And when I get out, it's a liberation. And so when some other parent hasn't bothered to get a babysitter and it's an inappropriate film for the child, I get annoyed. I think you should be really careful about that, both for your child and for the other people.
Well, people get baptized when they're a few months old and circumcised when they're a few days old. And I saw Rosemary's Baby when I was in the womb with my mom.
You're being awfully, like, what's with all the theological themes here, Kelly Wand?
Fantastic Mr. Fox is a mystical movie, and you know what? It would be on my desert island list.
You were in the womb with your mother?
She says.
And plus, Dingus, these children grow up to be adults who talk during movies.
Actually, I agree with Dingus. So.
In answer to your query, Tom, I was a little bit, I'm crazy about Wes Anderson, but I was a little bit nervous about this. I'd only seen a couple images because of my, predilection for avoiding trailers. And I just thought, why are you doing this? I was worried that he had succumbed to some sort of Robert Zemeckis syndrome.
Oh, ouch.
And so I was a little bit leery of it, and I kind of, right before I went to see it, I think we had a conversation, and I said, I can't believe we didn't decide to see Ninja Assassins. I was a little nervous about it.
Now, Dingus, you put your cards on the table first, because you were the one that held out longest last week. Did it work for you? What'd you think?
I can say, without any reservation, oh yeah, it worked for me.
Ah. Now, Kelly Wand, were you being facetious before we started recording when you were grumbling about not liking this movie, or did you, in fact, not like this movie?
I was being facetious. I thought it was brilliant. That was the greatest movie ever.
Now you're being facetious. You're messing with my triangulation on you here, Kelly Wand.
I love this movie. I cherish this movie, and it made me want to have kids just so I could make them watch it at 5 or 3. Even.
You're being facetious again.
No, I loved it. I loved it. I love Roald Dahl, and I thought it was a great adaptation. And it's one I hadn't read, so it kind of had a novelty to it.
This is exciting to me because I wanted to ask you if you had read it.
No.
Have any of us read it?
No. I've read a ton of Roald Dahl, but I didn't read that, and I think it's the only children's book I haven't read by him.
Huh. Yeah, I haven't read it either.
Did you read anything else by him? He wrote some cool Hitchcock Presents-y type stuff, too.
For like kids?
For stories. No, for Alfred Hitchcock types. For that famous episode where the guy bets his finger on whether he can make his lighter go 10 times. That was Roald Dahl. Did you ever see that? No?
Don't know that one, no. Sounds good.
I've read
Speaking to the void, as always.
I've read all of his wacky poems, like Where the Sidewalk Ends.
Oh, Dingus. Oh, good Lord.
He also wrote the script for You Only Live Twice. So, the Japanese one, as I call it.
That's what they say. Mm-hmm.
So I didn't read the book, but I did go onto Wikipedia and read the Wikipedia entry about the book. And apparently, the book has none of the prologue stuff about about the fox and his wife meeting. And it has none of the ending stuff. It just opens with the heist on the three farms, and it ends, I think, with the three farmers trying to wait out Mr. Fox around the hole where they brought the shovels and stuff out. So there's none of the ending and none of the beginning is there in the Roald Dahl book. All of that is Wes Anderson's stuff. Well, actually, and not just Wes Anderson. How about that? Because I didn't realize this. Noah Baumbach wrote the script with him. I love Baumbach.
Yeah, welcome back. Haven't they worked together before?
Oh, yeah, definitely, yeah. I thought you were going to make disparaging remarks about Margot at the wedding.
Tom, you're awfully paranoid tonight. You seem to be sensing anything but love coming from me and Dingus.
No. I'm paranoid. No, get it, please.
How can I make a disparaging remark about Noah Baumbach?
Well, I thought you were going to say something disparaging. I wasn't going to say about Noah Baumbach. I thought you were going to make a disparaging remark about Margot at the Wedding, which I liked much more than you did, Dingus.
Yeah.
That was his last movie. So when you said welcome back, I thought you meant welcome back from making sucky movies. So maybe I am being paranoid. Because I really liked Margot at the Wedding, and that was Noah Baumbach's last thing.
Well, I have no problem. I mean, I didn't really care for that, but Squid and the Whale makes up for anything coming after that, as far as I'm concerned, at least for a while.
And didn't he write Life Aquatic, or did I just make that up? Kelly, can you Google that for us?
Because, he did. You're right, he did.
Because this actually was almost like, there are so many points of continuity between this and Life Aquatic. They're both, I feel, you guys love the movie, we'll talk more about this in a bit. I feel they're both not entirely successful Wes Anderson movies. Both Fantastic Mr. Fox and Life Aquatic. They both feature a heist. They are both about a father-son conflict. They both have a mythical beast at the end of the movie, and they both have Willem Dafoe doing a weird accent.
When's the last time you saw Life Aquatic?
In the theaters.
Okay, because
they both have a lot of gunplay too.
Yeah, that's true.
Because I think that, and you're not going to like me saying this, but I think that the Fantastic Mr. Fox has much more in common with Royal Tenenbaums than it does with Life Aquatic,
But Royal Tenenbaums didn't have the mythical beast at the end. As I was watching, I was like, oh, that's like when they see the spotted shark or whatever at the end of Life Aquatic. But yeah, I definitely agree with you about Royal Tenenbaums, Dingus. Yeah.
So it didn't work for you, and now we put our cards on the table.
It did work. I just didn't feel it was entirely successful.
Talking about? That's my question to you.
What is what?
What didn't work for you?
Mainly the animation.
Oh, you're nuts. Oh,
Tom,
awesome.
What are you talking about?
Stop motion.
The animation. That's the act of animating the puppets. that's what that is. It's a technical term.
So the characters
this is actually what the person I saw the movie with said, and I think you're both high.
Did I go with you? Is that it? Okay, it was someone else.
He said something along the lines of, and tell me if this would encapsulate what you're saying. Well, he said if it had been CGI, the lines would have worked better because they would have had more expressive faces.
That was a problem for me, is that I didn't feel they were...
That lack of expression, A, makes the lines funnier, and B, they count as expressions. It's a timing thing. It's a rhythm. It's about rhythms.
Well,
yet it's sort of... it's.
Here's part of what the problem was for me is... when you look at I just watched WALL-E again last week. Dingus, you haven't seen Up, but once you've seen Up, which you'll need to fix that this year. Pixar does this amazing job of interconnecting the voice acting and the animation, and you get a sense that the animators are working from the tape, and you get a sense that the voice actors are watching the animation. Listening to George Clooney, it sort of seemed like he never saw a picture of that fox, and the people who built the fox, I sort of felt like they didn't know George Clooney was going to be cast. There wasn't whatever voodoo Pixar does, that sort of alchemy of voice acting and animation, what was missing for me, and at times it was a little distracting.
I couldn't disagree more. Go ahead. Keep going. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, and there was that expressionless look was just at times really sort of weird and creepy and robbed certain moments of the humanity that I think makes Wes Anderson so good, with little quiet moments and these sort of deadpan interactions. I think of the end of Royal Tenenbaums, where all this stuff has happened, and Wes Anderson does his wonderful tableau thing with the camera moving down the line of all these events and these people, and it settles on Gene Hackman and Ben Stiller. And Ben Stiller says, "I've had a really tough year, Dad." And Gene Hackman says, "I know you have, Jazzy." And just there's that beautiful human moment between the two of them, and that's in a way the crescendo of the movie. And,
there's tons of that in this.
Well, not that I felt that were that human. Like, I thought they were hidden behind a puppet, this weird expressionless glass-eyed puppet, which looked kind of cool at times, and I sort of appreciated the sort of rough-hewn stop-action animation behind it. But I just feel like it sort of robbed the movie of some of those kinds of moments.
Well, what's that form do for you in general, stop motion?
Oh, I love it. Like Coraline is, I think, that's another thing, too, is I kept comparing it to Coraline. Henry Selick, I don't know if you guys know this, was originally doing the animation.
Right.
And he left to do Coraline.
Yeah. Well, that's it's a win-win.
Well, you know, I kind of wonder. Like, I adore Coraline, but I got to wonder, like, how different would it have been if Henry Selick's animation crew had been doing it? And I don't know. I mean, obviously it would have been different, and I don't know if it would have been better. you guys, obviously the animation worked for you, and I want to hear more about this. But I kept thinking of Coraline, and Coraline's another example, too. They have that Pixar magic where the voice acting and the animation just seem just so sort of interleaved.
I liked Coraline a lot, but I liked this more.
Okay. Well, you guys talk a little about the animation. Obviously, it did work for you.
Well, I want to address specifically the hand-in-hand of the voice acting and the animation, because I thought the voice acting was phenomenal. And for once, I sort of started to lose, you know, when we talked about Where the Wild Things Are, that whole voice over derby that you go through. Mm-hmm. And I lost sight of that during this. There was a time during this movie when I forgot it was George Clooney, which shocks me because he's so obvious. And I just started not caring who was doing what. And because to me, it was more like I was watching a Wes Anderson film, and I knew I was in a comfortable cast of characters or a group of people that work on his films. And I felt like I was with, I was in a family reunion or with a group of family, and I thought that it worked seamlessly. I thought it was beautiful, and specifically, I just can't get over Meryl Streep. She is so unbelievably sexy and amazing. And I'm sorry just to blurt that out, but I didn't know she was his wife, and I didn't know it till the end, but I kept hearing little things she would say that would say, "Oh, I know that voice, but I don't. Who is that?" And then I just wouldn't care. And she's just so good. She's so good at everything she does, and I just didn't have any of those problems. I thought the voice acting and the animation worked beautifully together.
I did love the scene of the two of them in front of the waterfall. Just visually, and what both Clooney and Meryl Streep were doing at that point. And that was another thing. I mean, that was close to that "I've had a rough year, Dad, I know" Chazzy scene. But again, I was looking at puppets the whole time, and I didn't.
Well, for me, it was when you watch the scene where in Royal Tenenbaums, where Royal is telling what's the character's name, Etheline, that he's dying. Mm-hmm. There's that back and forth scene, and when I watch that, when they have that back and forth where he tells her he's dying and they say he's not, and then she smacks him in the head and he says, "No, I really am dying," that's where I really started to think, "Oh, wow, this is Fox." I mean, there's some of that, and I understand what you're saying. There's not that same emotional depth, but I think these are different styles.
They're very different styles, and when you mention that scene there, Dingus, that just brings it home all the more, because that slap, and I think you've seen the outtakes, right? That slap where she hits him was not scripted. Like, he actually mutters under his breath, "God damn," because she hits him too hard. And they cut the line out. You know, they Foley out his comment. But there's so much just impromptu, just humanity in that scene between the two of them. And they can't – I felt like the animator just couldn't quite pull off that level of Wes Anderson-ness. And I just missed it a little bit. And I never felt that way about, like, Coraline. Maybe because I didn't have the expectations of Coraline. But when you mention that scene, Dingus, I think, you know, they can't pull off something like who was that? Olivia Houston? No. Angelica Houston.
Angelica, yeah.
Houston smacking Gene Hackman harder than she meant to. I mean, that's just such an awesome acting moment, and you can't have that with puppets. And
so it's an unfair comparison.
Absolutely. Absolutely an unfair comparison.
And you're a bastard for not liking this movie.
I'm not saying I like the movie quite a bit. I really like the movie. No, don't say I like the movie, but I think it is, to borrow a phrase from The Squid and the Whale, I think it's lesser Anderson.
You know, I think that it's more, I think you need to think of it as, yeah, that's my little boy. He'll be fine.
I thought it was Tom, sorry.
It's Tom. I think it's more, if you're looking sort of at animation branches, I think it's more Wallace and Gromit than it is
yeah.
than it is Henry Selick. And I hear your sort of disgust when you say that. But when I was watching it, the animation has that beautiful, very clean. It's so clean. I mean, that's what you primarily think when you're sitting there. It's just so clean looking. And it immediately made me think of Wallace and Gromit. And it turns out that the DP is a guy who worked on Wallace and Gromit, Chicken Run. Yeah. Whereas Henry Selick did the animation for the little animated bits in Life Aquatic. And that film is a little darker. And I think this is sort of a cleaner branch of animation and storytelling. So it's not sort of on the Coraline edge of things. And I understand why Coraline appeals to you more, but I think this is just a different branch.
Well, Coraline is more expressive. I mean, you will grant me that. These are, they're not, like the cat, for instance, in Coraline is so stylized and looks nothing like a cat, and they don't try to put realistic fur and glass eyes in him. Whereas here, they're trying to make the badger look like a badger and the fox look like a fox, and I imagine it's partly an homage to whoever illustrated Roald Dahl's books. But Coraline has a completely different approach to the visuals. You use the word clean, Dingus, but I'm almost inclined to. It almost feels a little bit more rough hewn, or maybe tactile. Like that, you can almost feel the fur, and the fur really does look like artificial fake fur stuck on a puppet.
I love that.
And that's fine. You know, that was a choice. Yeah.
And when you see something like that cry, it's somehow more affecting than if a CG character. It's like a kid's toy crying. Like like you go back to a kid when.
Tom, are you? Do you feel like that there's a difference in emotional stakes?
No, not really. Then what do you mean a difference from Coraline? Or
yeah, do you feel like that the stakes are higher in Coraline than they are in something like Mr. Fox?
I think they're very different stories, and I think their stakes don't compare at all because Coraline is a child's fantasy, whereas this is very much a movie about adult situations, about adult life, family life. So the stakes, I feel, don't really compare. I don't know if that answers what you're getting at.
It doesn't, because I'm pushing you a little bit on this because you are choosing to compare these, and I think you should have to compare.
Well, for the stop motion, for the quality of the animation, that's pretty much what I'm talking about. The expressiveness, the animation, and the way it works with the voice acting. The way it never feels like one is sort of running roughshod over the other. At times I was like, hey, that's George Clooney talking, and at other times I was like, wow, that's a puppet fox someone built. And they never sort of felt seamless to me. You used the word seamless before, Dingus, and I just never really got that impression.
But it was a fox they built with love.
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely skillfully done, and I appreciated, you know, like the fact that whenever there was smoke, it was cotton. And for instance, when there's smoke in Coraline, it's a digital effect. You know, that's one of the few post-processing bits they did in Coraline is the fog. And I got the sense there was no post-processing here. Everything was tactile. You know, that smoke was you know, billowy, you know, stacks of cotton done with stop motion.
It was a handmade universe, Tom.
Yeah. And it was lovely. I mean, I liked the movie. I quite liked it.
And a comedy timing is a very delicate thing. And Coraline had it easy because it didn't have to worry about that as much. It was never trying to be funny. And when it did try to be funny, it wasn't funny.
I'm not going to go there. But here's what I was struck by watching this. Wes Anderson, he is so meticulous about the details of what's in the frame and who's doing what. And he's as stylized as David Mamet. And it takes a very specific actor to do Wes Anderson. And I remember being a little worried seeing Adrian Brody in Darjeeling Limited, but being just so delighted that he just rose to the occasion, and he's one of he's one of the Wes Anderson faithful now. He got that. So I was struck watching this, what a luxury it must have been for Wes Anderson to be able to control inanimate objects and to not have that messy human element. I mean, he's so in love with the tableau, and to be able to have every little thing, like, and even smoke, you know, was something that he could touch and move and bend and have go precisely where he wanted it to go. I was sort of struck by that watching this. What a great opportunity for what must be a control freak like Wes Anderson.
I love that comment, Tom. That's a really great way to put it, because I think it's I don't know if you mean it this way, but I think it's very complimentary of
them.
And that's what I thought too when I was watching this, and why I brought up Robert Zemeckis earlier and indulged me for talking about him, but I cannot for the life of me understand why he's using, and I don't know what the term is for this animation that he's using right now for every film he seems to do.
What, the 3D?
I'm going to shoot the whole film, and then we're going to make everybody look like they're carved out of butter. I have no idea why.
And that's the trend. Like every movie is going to be like that.
It seems like it. And while I liked a lot of Beowulf, and I, if I remember correctly, I think you liked it a lot more than I did, Tom. Is that right?
Yeah, I just didn't mind it as much as
you. I'm a Beowulf apologist.
I wouldn't say I don't apologize. I just didn't mind it as much as you did, Dingus. But go ahead.
I just cannot understand why he's doing it. If he's going to go to the trouble of shooting all of these things, and it's not just green screen. I mean, they have like full costumes. They're working with sets, as far as I understand, and then they're animating after the fact. And I was nervous going in that Wes Anderson was falling into this kind of trap that he's just doing this to do it. And when I was sitting there watching it, I immediately felt like, okay, this is. Of course this has to be animated. This is furthering the story. Whereas with these other films, I don't see that how that's furthering the story so much as somebody playing with new toys. And I didn't have that feeling. I had that feeling more that – and what you said, Tom, really, really gives voice to what I was saying is that he gets a chance to be precise. And a lot of people say he's precious or twee. I think – I don't know. They have a lot of different pejorative words for what Wes Anderson does, but I think precision is a beautiful way to put it. And when you look at the way he frames everything in Darjeeling Limited, and you see all of those little pictures, and then you watch Mr. Fox after that, I love what your comment says about him as a filmmaker and how justifiable it was to do this as an animated film. I'm very, very happy that he did this.
Because that's what I get the sense with Zemeckis, that when he does this animation, it's just to sort of become unfettered and be able to do things where the camera can follow Jim Carrey riding a broom down a chimney or whatever, or that Goofy swinging around in Beowulf and the raptors, and the camera is just unhinged and can do whatever it wants, and you have these video game sequences. Like Zemeckis, he's using animation to just sort of get sloppy and unmoored. But here, yeah, the Wes Anderson was using animation to do what he does even more carefully. So I absolutely agree with you, Dingus. Yeah.
Yeah, and I don't understand how precision and meticulousness became a slur. Like, that's a bad thing for a because I remember after Hudsucker Proxy came out, everyone went, yeah, those Coens, they're such control freaks. Everything in their frame has to be there a certain way. God, boo, so distancing, no human element. And then Fargo came out next year, and I was like, oh, yeah, those Coens, man, they're so meticulous. It's great.
Well, go ahead, Dingus.
Well, I just think, and I'll try not to get political here, but I think it's analogous to how elite or elitism became pejorative. So that when you're precise, you're not authentic somehow. You're not real. Everything is controlled, so it's not real. And I think that's part of it.
But he's a genius with the tableau, and I was so aware of this throughout this movie. And here's an example. When they're showing the different heist scenes, the second heist is all one frame, and it's the security guard sitting there eating his vegetable-filled donut or whatever that was, facing the camera. And in the background behind him are the four monitors, the four screens of security cameras, and you see the heist going through sequence 1, 2, 3, 4 as Mr. Fox and Kylie, I think was the guy's name, move through each of the monitors. And it's so precisely framed, and each one unfolds so carefully. Each one tells a little piece of the story, and it's just... You know, people talk about things like using comic book conventions to tell stories in panels, and that stuff does nothing for me. You know, somebody who can, though, take a tableau like Wes Anderson does and use it to tell stories and put meaningful details on the frame, that's such a treasure.
You know what I think of when you describe that, Tom, is this moment in Darjeeling Limited when the brothers are about to get on the bus after the funeral, and you, and the camera shows them.
Yeah,
swivels to the boy who's going to flag down the bus, swivels to somebody who's just walked up, swivels over to them again, and there's a couple guys, and they look at him, swivels back to the boy, and it keeps swiveling and swiveling and swiveling until more and more of a crowd show up, and they pray with them, and they get on the bus. There's this beautiful – you have this feeling that everything he wants is going to be assembled exactly just so, but I never feel like there is a lack of emotion there.
Yeah. When we saw it, Dingus, I don't know if you remember, our friend Ryan, I think, specifically thought that the camera work there was intrusive. But on the contrary, I feel the camera work in that scene that you're talking about, Wes Anderson knows that that's part of how he tells the story, and it's crucial to the storytelling. What he does and doesn't do with the camera, I never feel is gratuitous. I just really appreciate how he can move it and not move it and make it matter, whether it's doing one or the other. Yeah.
It's an abundance of emotion. Go on, sorry.
Yeah, no, that's a lovely way to put it. That's why Life Aquatic is so weird for me. It is so awful. I wanted to ask you when I was thinking about this, where this film sits in Wes Anderson, as far as I mean by this film, Mr. Fox, where it sits in his career so far. What I wanted to ask you guys are just sort of, I don't know if you want to address this right now or if you even want to answer this question, but I wanted to ask the two of you, Kelly and Tom, who's your favorite director?
What?
Isn't this a 3x3?
Yeah. No, it's not.
I'm suspicious of anybody who can name a favorite movie, I'm equally suspicious of anybody who can name a favorite director. How dare you?
Living or dead?
Okay, no, it doesn't matter. So you can't name that, Tom. Kelly, can you?
Most consistent or just, well, I don't know.
Don't worry about it.
Kubrick's good. Scorsese's good.
Where are you going with this, Dingus? What's up? What do you got up your sleeve?
All right, I apologize. You guys don't have to answer.
It's a sandbag.
You don't have to answer it. It is kind of a sandbag. But when I was thinking about this movie and how it really touched me, I was just having to consider that Wes Anderson might very well be my favorite director. Okay. And I can't think of another director who's done like these many different movies and then thrown in an animated movie that I like this much and was willing to take that kind of a risk. And I really appreciate that about him. And you guys don't have to answer the question of your favorite director. I understand you don't want to disappoint anybody.
Some of the others might be listening and we don't want to offend them.
Yeah, they very well might. So anyway, go ahead, move.
Well, I'll wait until Martin Scorsese's Super Fudge comes out before you put the. Anyway.
Yeah, Dingus, if you're gonna have to explain that to Rennie Harlan next time you and him are hanging out because he might get wind of you saying that.
Rennie and I aren't really talking very much anymore. Because
wait until McGee's The Phantom Tollbooth comes out before.
I got that one, Kelly. That was good. I like that. Let's talk about specific moments because so you guys know about my reservations with the animation that kicked in early on, but there were definitely it was one of two moments. I'm not sure which one came first, where I finally warmed up to it. And I was like, okay, I'm going to enjoy this. I like what he's doing. I appreciate it. It was either the lab scene where you cut to Ash in the lab with, I forget the girl.
You're disloyal.
Yeah, that was just so Wes Anderson. I mean, I loved that moment. It's either that or the Beagles Like Blueberries bit. but at one of those two points, I was like, okay, my resistance has crumbled. I'm enjoying this, and I'm looking forward to seeing where it goes.
It took you that long to.
It really did. I mean, and you know what?
Wow. Maybe you're tough rip, Tom.
Well, like I said, I mean, I think I've really been spoiled by some just absolutely ingenious animation lately, and this I just didn't feel was on par with that.
But just the script alone, I mean, the humor and the cleverness.
Well, that's another thing I want to talk about a little bit later, is I'm not sure what to make of the script, and we'll get to that in a second, but I want you guys to tell me about some specific moments that you really enjoyed or that you really warmed up to or that stood out for you.
You first, Kelly.
Pass.
Well, I'm trying to remember the setup, but the scene where he karate kicks the cage and it breaks, mm-hmm. and he's replacing, he's saving his friend, or the friend he doesn't like. He goes, I have mixed feelings about you saving me.
Okay, yeah, wait, you're right, because there was a bunch of subtext in that scene. Okay, I guess I'm actually thinking of when he says, I'm sorry. Because doesn't, in that same scene, he says, I'm sorry. There's like an apology. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, and then what's the crew?
So there's Christofferson, which
Christofferson,
an awesome name, and Ash.
Yeah, Christofferson says something like, was this the apology you did?
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. That's good. I liked all the Christofferson scenes.
Yeah.
And Ash. It was a great B story.
Well, you say it was a B story, but I really think, I mean, and this is getting a little ahead of what I want to talk about next, but I really think this, you know, the heart of the story is the father-son conflict, and that's a huge part of it, is this idea of Christofferson displacing Ash. But we'll get to that in a minute. So, Dingus, what stood out for you? And because I know you wrote in your little notebook, I really like this scene a lot. And then you wrote the name. You wrote the scene.
What? You really nailed my writer's voice, by the way. I could talk about moments all day, and I'll be happy to. A lightweight one is when he's in the office with the attorney, and it's very clearly a callback to Royal Tenenbaums. When he's doing, "Are you cussing me? Are you cussing me?" I love that little moment because it's very much the talk jive thing.
Yeah, I disagree with you. I can't go with you there. I see what you're getting at, but I disagree.
What do you disagree with? That it's a good moment or that it's a callback?
That it's a callback. They're very different dynamics, I think.
Okay. Have you seen
Royal Tenenbaums? Plus one stop motion. And
Royal Tenenbaums, that scene, I'll talk some jive like you never heard, is very much Royal being kicked out of his family. It's him trying to reclaim his place as a father, as the titular head of the household, whereas the Badger and the Fox are just two buddies who are used to doing this kind of thing with each other. There was no real contention there. I mean, I there's a lot of subtext in the Royal Tenenbaum scene, and I don't think there's so much subtext here. It's just two guys goofing off.
Yeah, but I still think it's just a little callback to that little moment.
Okay.
But you agree, disagree.
But that was cute, yeah. And that's, by the way, another thing, I kept thinking, that's not a Badger, that's Bill Murray. I don't know.
But it's Bill Murray playing a badger. Like, if he was in the movie just playing a lawyer, you wouldn't go, oh, it's Bill Murray. He's wearing a lawyer suit. He's playing a lawyer in this movie.
I would, and I would like it.
Well, see, I don't understand that leap, or not making that leap. But
maybe it's
a leap to get into musicals that I can't make, so maybe it's the same thing.
I think, Kelly Wand, that there are some actors, there's a reason I think that Pixar doesn't do that DreamWorks bullcrap of casting famous people to be their characters, is that some people's voices, their celebrity, upstages what the animators are trying to do.
I know what you're saying, and I agree with you.
And I just think...
Wait a minute. Did you just say Pixar doesn't do that bullcrap of casting celebrities?
I did.
Have you seen Toy Story?
Have you seen Up? No. Have you seen WALL-E?
Yes, I have.
Toy Story. And Toy Story, by the way, it's like, you know, I'll grant you that when Pixar was starting out and they had to do a movie, they needed star power to get a movie made. Yeah. There's a reason. Do you see since then instances of that? Like in later Pixar movies, can you point to that? Albert Brooks in the lead. No voiceover for any of the characters in WALL-E.
WALL-E is a special
Ed Asner. You know, there's no, they don't do that anymore. They did.
Monster. Did you see Monsters, Inc.?
Oh, and I hated it. Oh, I didn't want to listen to Billy Crystal be a blob.
Billy Crystal and John Goodman. They do it. Of course they do it. Come on.
They don't do it regularly. I think I think Pixar is very careful about characters who upstage their animation.
Okay, I'll grant you that they don't do it regularly, and they're willing to take risks with things like WALL-E.
Right.
And WALL-E is a special case, and you're absolutely right.
And but they
let's not pretend that they don't do it.
They don't. Not anymore. They're done. They got that out of their system. They've said they'll never do it again, and they apologized to me.
In writing?
Oh, yeah.
I guess you're right, though. Owen Wilson is a car. That's kind of pretty distinctive, too, isn't it?
I didn't see that one. He's the car?
Isn't Owen Wilson the main character? Yeah, and you can't mistake Owen Wilson.
Who's the girl car?
I think it's Julia Louis-Dreyfus, if I'm not mistaken. I could
so
be.
Owen Wilson's hooking up with Julia Louis-Dreyfus.
You know what? Don't quote me on that. The Cars sort of went in one ear and out the other.
Those DreamWorks movies, they also...
So before you... Those, by the way. So that, I think, is a classic example. I'm not watching a donkey. I'm watching Eddie Murphy.
Well, and they're doing little corporate puns.
Yeah.
Stuff.
Yeah.
Like in Shark Tale. That are only... That date the humor, which Pixar doesn't do so much. And
certainly this movie didn't do.
No, it didn't.
And love it to death for
it's
that.
It's timeless. 20 years later, 20 years from now, everyone will get all these jokes.
So, okay, let's talk about it in the story. So what...
No. Wait. Let me give one more
moment. Oh, okay, okay.
I'm sorry, but I was just so taken with Meryl Streep. I'm just really into her. Yeah, thank you. I think she's my favorite actor. And
so favorite director and favorite actor after one movie you've made.
Yeah, there you go. There's this moment where they come in, and it's a total cliched moment when Fox is sneaking back into the house, and she's in the shadows, like in the pantry. And she comes out, and her line is, "If what I think is happening is happening,
yes,
it better not be.
It'll be happening."
And I loved that character. I loved it when I don't have the line at my fingertips, but when she's fighting with the rat and she says, "Am I being flirted with by a psychotic rat?"
Yeah.
And every time she spoke, I just was swooning, and I'm crazy about Meryl Streep. I'm just crazy about her.
And by the way, that's another thing. I mean, for someone with her celebrity, I don't know if it's a matter of that. Maybe her Fox design or something, but I never got that sense with Meryl Streep, though. I mean, I never felt like she was upstaging the animation, and I don't know why that is. Maybe because I love her more than you, Dingus. I don't know.
Hey, how dare you? I never got that sense either, but I think it's just that, and usually I get really annoyed. I mean, you guys heard me talking about how annoyed I was when we talked about Where the Wild Things Are, about how voice actors, really professional voice actors, are being denied work because celebrities want to have an easy gig. And she comes in and does this. I don't know what other animation she's done, but she was fantastic. She's just such a natural. And she was just so good in this little part. I loved it.
Has she done other animation before? Because I couldn't think of anything.
I have no idea. And I didn't bother to look, but I was just taken with her when I realized it was her. And it wasn't until I watched the credits that I realized it. Because I didn't care.
Hey, when she was shooting Ironweed, she lay on an ice cube so she could know how it felt to be dead, FYI.
No, I don't like her anymore. Thanks, Kelly.
Spoiler alert.
All right, Tom, go ahead and talk about story now.
Well, I'm just curious what you guys take away from the story. Like, for me, Coraline, for instance, has a very clear story. I love the sort of the message it gets. Like, I love the idea of a child watching Coraline. I'm not sure what to make of this, and I'm not sure what or if this is even something you guys care about. Like, what's sort of the takeaway point? Fantastic.
You and your points. Not everything has to have a point. That's its point.
Okay. I mean, if that's a fair answer, Kelly Wand. But I do think there are things here about
life lessons.
About And I think it's very much Royal Tenenbaums. I mean, I think this is sort of an animated version of Royal Tenenbaums in that it's a story about family, about a father-son reconciliation. And it's even got elements of Bottle Rocket with the heist and this sort of affectionate regard for heists. So I don't know. Is that not something that you guys think about or that you guys care about that much?
I certainly do think about that, Tom, and I'm a little distracted by having just watched Darjeeling Limited and seeing the way that film turns in the middle and goes in a different direction after the river scene, and how much more it's affected me in subsequent viewings of it. And there's nothing like that in Fantastic Mr. Fox. So I don't know where to go with what the message of the film is, if that's what you're looking for, other than it's telling a children's story for adults. which is why I don't think taking kids to this really makes any sense. It's an enjoyable heist film, and it has a great father-son relationship, but I don't think it's a kids movie.
Why would kids want to see those things?
Well, here, Kelly Wand, I can just my little anecdotal evidence amongst the chattering kids about, and it wasn't even at the halfway point. It was fairly early in the movie. One little kid, like two rows behind me, says, "This is too long."
But that kid's an idiot.
Well, you know, I really don't. I think Dingus is onto something, and this is part of what I talk about. Is I don't think this is a kid's.
Cool kids will like it.
I don't think there's much here for kids. I mean, I really do think it's a movie about.
I would
adult,
have liked it.
But I think it's a movie about adult issues, things that matter to adults that kids appreciate or understand. And that's sort of what I'm getting at is.
Yeah, you get both. The kid characters, you can see that scene where Christofferson's kind of crying and then Ash kind of feels bad. So he comes down and they play with the trains together. That's good for kids.
That was a great scene, by the way.
That was another, by the way,
Kelly Wand, would be one point where I would sort of. That might be the closest it came to that. I've had a really rough year. I know, Chazzy. That was a beautiful, and there was no voice acting in that.
No,
that was just done with the animation, and it wasn't even like it was. Weren't they mostly in silhouette and the lighting?
Yeah,
I mean that was just a beautiful little moment that I kind of wish there'd been more of those. And I know there were attempts at it, but I kept thinking, oh, there's George Clooney. Yeah, Bill Murray. That's not a badger.
That's a great point, Kelly. I think this is a film for kids who are in Wes Anderson films. So Max Fisher might have liked it, but I don't think Noah Mitchell would.
I think some would and some wouldn't. I wouldn't tar all kids with the same brush for this movie.
Well, I think it's more for us.
Yeah, I think it's very much.
I got a lot out of it, but I would think if I was with a kid who liked this, I would respect that kid more. Because it's a good movie. And it's like the kids who read Harry Potter now instead of Roald Dahl. I get people who get mad at me for comparing. Like there's, you know, you're not supposed to compare kids' authors. But Roald Dahl's better. Like if they were reading that, they would know and they would like it more. But Harry Potter's made them lazy and like dumb things.
I'll go on board with that.
And Fantastic Mr. Fox would be good for them. I think it would give them something to grow on. I think the stuff with the adult characters, it would give them an insight into how their parents think and, you know, their dad's trying to make ends meet, even if it's shady. There's stuff, I don't know, I think kids would want to know. I mean, the whole thing about whether something is a kids movie or not seems such an overrated argument to me. Because if it speaks to you on any level, it should speak to you at all levels.
Well, here's why I wonder, Kelly Wand, is I think if, you know, Dingus has a son who just turned 5, and I think, you know, what, obviously you're going to have to start thinking about this, Dingus, what kinds of movies do you want, and stories even, do you want to present to your son? You know, what things, because he's at a formative age, and the stories he's going to read are going to inform him in very important ways. So, you know, things like, you know, would you want, and this is sort of what I wonder as a father, you must be thinking, is this something I would want my kid to see? You know, what's the message that my kid would get from this? And it's why I really love Coraline, is I think Coraline has this very sophisticated message cloaked in terms a kid can understand about, hey, be careful what you wish for. You know, the fantasy world is all good and well, but appreciate what's here in real life too. Like it's this really subversive kid's fantasy that's in a way sort of talking about the dangers of fantasy. And I love that.
That's good. But this movie's message, I would say, is you can count on your friends and your family and stick together and things will work out.
Which is very much Royal Tenenbaums or The Incredibles, kind of. Like, I think very much in that vein. Yeah.
But why is it that we think because something is animated, we have to have kids in the discussion at all?
Right.
Why is it that I'm... We have this discussion about the Fantastic Mr. Fox is related to what stories we're going to tell our children, and we don't have that discussion about Darjeeling Limited or The Road or Let the Right One In. This is just a different way of telling a story. Now, it is from something that is, quote-unquote, a children's book, but I've never read that.
And we only say that because it's got talking animals in it.
Well, but to, you know, animation is just another way of telling a story. It's just another way of filming a story. And whether or not it has anything to do with kids, it is divorced from the idea of whether or not we call it a cartoon, I think.
Yeah. I think that's an American phenomenon, maybe. I think in other cultures, they use cartoons all the time.
That's not true. You made that up.
I don't know what I'm saying. That was the stupidest sentence ever on any of these podcasts.
Do you understand what I'm saying though, Tom?
I do, but I mean, this is, I'm speaking, you know, this is from a book that I presume Roald Dahl wrote for children. And when I saw it, it was a theater full of 6-year-olds who got very restless and who, you know, they got briefly reinterested during the dog cam attack. But for the most part, the movie was lost on them. They got nothing from it. They didn't appreciate it. And in the back of my head, I'm thinking, well, I hope those kids saw Coraline and learned about the dangers of fantasy. You know, I mean, that's sort of what's going on.
Maybe 6 is too young.
Maybe so. And that's a lot. There's a lot of
12 or 10.
Or, you know what? A 14-year-old girl watching this. I mean, that's a whole different thing. Like that probably, I can imagine, being a valuable experience.
Or Carey Mulligan.
Tom, let me ask you something real quick. Without you having to give anything away, do you remember what the audience was when you saw Up?
I do not, no.
You saw it in a theater, yeah?
I did, and Up is an interesting case study for this sort of discussion. I mean, Up, as I told you, Dingus, Up is written by Tom McCarthy,
who, right.
And it shows. But Up has a lot for kids. Up is not a kids movie. Up is sort of like this, in that I don't think it's about kids stuff.
But you don't remember if it was packed with kids or not?
Oh, I don't, but I do know. I think I could safely say that Up would engage a child throughout, if that's
okay.
What I'm asking.
Okay. Yeah, well, I am asking that. I was hoping that you would tell me whether or not people were restless or not. But it's a different sort of children's film than this is.
Yeah, and Pixar, I mean, they're just – those guys are just brilliant at this. I mean, Pixar knows how to engage children without alienating adults and vice versa.
Yeah, good point.
Those guys are just magic. And
Well, I hope Wes Anderson makes more Roald Dahl adaptations.
You know, that's interesting because I was like, okay, he did this. It's an experiment. It's like I was saying earlier.
It's his country album.
And go back and do your live action stuff now. I mean, that was sort of my thinking. But I guess you liked it enough that you want more Wes Anderson animation, yeah?
I don't necessarily need any more Wes Anderson animation. I just like that that's the way he chose to tell the story, and he was interested in doing that. And it was the perfect way to tell this story. And I would prefer him move on to the next proper way to tell a story rather than get wedded to something just because it's an interesting toy or he liked it or whatever. It seems to me that he has an understanding of this is how to tell a story. This is how to tell this specific story. And that's why Fantastic Mr. Fox worked for me so much, because I felt like, okay, this is the way to tell this story, and I can't imagine it live action. Whereas when we saw Where the Wild Things Are, I felt like that was up for debate.
Ah, right. Yep.
Huh. Well, those caterwauling 6-year-olds will come to appreciate this movie in the years to come. If they're cool.
1, 2, 3, not only you and me, got 180 degrees, and I'm caught in between, counting 1, 2, 3, Peter Pan, Mary, free, getting down with 3 feet, everybody loves
old. I hope I didn't cut off some deep, profound insight, Kelly Wan.
I don't think that's possible.
This week's 3x3, brought to you by me, are three instances of movie scenes that break the rules, that subvert your expectations. The examples that I gave when I threw this out to you guys last week are Indiana Jones, where, you know, he whips out the gun and he shoots the guy with the sword. Or
spoiler.
Famous shark eating Samuel Jackson when he's doing the inspirational.
Spoiler.
I expect you guys have come up with your three instances.
These are just lists of spoilers, aren't they, really?
You know what, though? I think 3x3 we can be elliptical about it, but I think you're kind of allowed to sort of spoil.
No, no, but this particular list is like stuff that would, if it was, if you knew it before you went in, it would be, oh, you spoiled the Samuel Jackson thing.
Yeah, but that's, right. You know what, that's the price you pay to listen to us talk.
There's a lot of prices.
True.
For free.
It's not as much a spoiler as the first couple we did, which were the films that were ruined by the last moment.
It's kind of true.
What idiot came up with that?
I don't know.
Oh, glad
we Kelly Wand, you're starting us off because you'll be introducing our next week's 3x3 later on. What is your number three movie that played
my
on
my number three? And I found the challenge of this list was to try and think of subverted expectations that didn't involve a debt. Excuse me.
That didn't involve debt?
A death.
Ah.
Like a character dying.
Okay. Because
usually it's someone dying you don't think is going to die. Like in The Departed, which isn't on my list. Ha ha! If you picked that one, are you gonna play the music again?
Want to show?
My number three subverted expectation 3x3 selection nominee is the great Waldo Pepper.
What?
Oh, something from before you were born.
Isn't that about like World War One biplanes, like doing stunt airships?
Yeah, it's Robert Redford, George Roy Hill director, your favorite director after
Only other movie besides Bonnie and Clyde.
No, that's Arthur Penn, fool.
Ah, rats.
Get off the movie podcast. What's wrong with you? Bonnie and Clyde's my number two. But anyway.
So what's the scene?
Yeah.
The scene is Robert Redford and William Goldman actually talks about this being like what ruined the movie for the studio. Like it wound up becoming a bomb based entirely on this one scene, which is where Susan Sarandon is a girl in the movie who's doing like a wing walker stunt, and she falls and dies. And he doesn't save her in time, but it's like this scene that sort of goes on for a long time, like a Spielberg, like, oh, he's going to rescue her. And then he doesn't at the last second. And then the audience is just like, oh. And wow. Then the air went out of him, and then no one liked the rest of the movie.
And that's Susan Sarandon.
Yeah, her death scene.
Do you remember how old? That movie's got to be like 1952.
75, 76, somewhere in there.
Okay. Wow.
She played the part of Mary Beth, the wing walker. Wing walker? Yeah, wing walker.
With Nicolas Cage.
I hate this podcast and my list.
No, wait a minute, Kelly. I thought you said you were trying to avoid deaths.
Well, this was the only one. Yeah, I know. I just wanted to make you guys look dumb.
Mission accomplished.
So that's the only one on my list that involves a death, technically.
That's a good one. You know what that makes me think of is the opening of Cliffhangers.
Or
Cliffhanger. Yeah. Sylvester Stallone one where he doesn't save the girl.
Cliffhangers, where he's writing all these novels.
Shut up! Speaking of Rennie Harlan, isn't that Rennie Harlan? I got one director.
Yeah, actually, you know what? You're right. That's actually a trope used often in action movies, is they didn't save someone. And like in the Denzel Washington one with Russell Crowe as the evil replicant. What was that one called?
Virtuosity?
Virtuosity.
Oh, nice. Good job, Tom.
Yeah, good work. I'm proud of you.
Make up for my George Roy Hill.
He had like a cyborg arm in it. Remember Denzel Washington?
Nobody saw Virtuosity, Kelly Wand.
Never mind. Anyway, he didn't save the chick, and then that's his character arc. And that's basically – so it's odd that in 1975 that was considered – oh, that you can't do that.
That's
you
a good
can't
one.
Kill off Susan Sarandon.
All right, I like that. Dingus, what's your number three?
My number three scene that subverted expectations comes from a movie called Pineapple Express. And it's just a goofy little moment where the line that precedes it is Seth Rogen saying, "Kick out the window, isn't that what they do?" And there's just to set the table for people who may not have seen it, there's a police car chase. And James Franco is driving a police car, and he can't see through the windshield, and they're getting shot at. And Seth Rogen tells him to kick out the windshield, and he tries to, and his foot just goes through it.
That is so awesome. Yeah. And there are shots of the car driving along with
his... Yeah, with his foot through it. It's obviously fake foot. It's awesome.
Because you totally expect the windshield just to fold over and them just to drive without a windshield. And instead, his foot just punches a hole through it. And eventually, he gets his foot back in and he goes, "I can see through my foothole."
love that movie.
Yeah, me too.
It's a good one. Dude. God, I hate my number three now. Let me come up with a new one. Hold on. So,
you guys,
my number three is someone dying. Kelly, you screwed it up for me. And it's almost a ripoff of yours. I want you to know I thought of this before I heard your Great Waldo Pepper thing.
Whatever you say, Tom.
So in Alien, it's the moment that Tom Skerritt turns around and gets killed by the alien. Because back then, in science fiction movies, it was always like the captain or whatnot who's supposed to be the sole survivor. Either that or you clearly identify early on in the horror movie that it's going to be the plucky young babysitter or whatever. So Alien not only broke the rules, it sort of rewrote them. And now, since post-Alien, you can kill the captain. You can kill the dashing lead. And so many movies think that it's really cool and subversive when they do that, and it's not. I think of that guy that did those terrible Feast movies from Project Greenlight. It's almost like he seems to think it's cool, but it's almost like a recurring joke that, you know, a young dashing hero kind of guy is going to, an authority figure is going to save him, and then he gets killed. But I think of Alien doing that first.
Haha, you saw Feast.
I saw Feast, Feast 2, and Feast 3.
What?
Yeah, how about that?
I don't believe there are three or that you saw them.
There are three. The second one involves jury rigging a catapult using the leather tops of biker chicks and parts from their motorcycle to fling midgets from one building to another.
No.
It's true. That's true.
Say that about every movie.
That's true.
That's his elevator.
That again. Not after Nadine.
That's his elevator pitch. I'm embarrassed to admit this. I don't remember when the Tom Skerritt death happens.
I think it's only so John Hurt's the first one to die.
Right.
By the way, that's also mildly subversive because back then, I think it was 79, he was probably the most recognizable actor. So yes. They kill him first. And then I think Harry Dean Stanton goes. And then it's only after then that they realize it's in the vents and Dallas, Tom Skerritt's character, says, I'll flush it out.
With his famous last words, I think I want to get the hell out of here.
Is that true? Is that his last line?
Yeah.
That's awesome.
They cut a scene where she finds him later and he's in the cocoon.
Right.
He goes,
right.
Kill me.
But that's not in the movie, so that's not canon, so he gets killed.
Well, she could have just not found it.
No, you can't make up stuff like that.
Why didn't she find the cocoon? Never mind.
I'm sure it was like a pacing thing or something.
If you're George Lucas, you can. You can endlessly make up stuff like that.
Ridley Scott wanted to end Alien with the alien talking in Ripley's voice on the diary I read.
Oh, good lord.
I got Wikipedia.
Can't wait till he does Blood Meridian. All right, Kelly Wand, what's your number two?
My number two, this is my only good one, I think, is Kingpin, where Bill Murray wins the bowling game. Instead of Woody Harrelson, and he's like the total dick villain character, and he wins in the third act in this come from behind victory where it, I don't know, it's great. It's the best scene in the movie, really.
You a big fan of the Farrelly brothers? Is that you like?
It was their last movie before they, after There's Something About Mary, they completely jumped the shark. But Dumb and Dumber's an American classic, I would say. And Kingpin's about, it's sort of Army of Darkness-esque. It's sort of hit and miss, but you need it.
Well put. Okay.
T-Y.
So the idea, though, is that you're thinking that Woody Harrelson is going to win, and they do a last-minute reversal where actually the good guy loses. Is that the deal?
You didn't see it?
Why would I see? No.
Oh.
It's a sports movie, first of all.
Bowling?
Yeah.
Sport, isn't it? I can't believe you didn't see Kingpin. It's so weird to me.
I don't know sports.
It's quite a sports movie.
All right.
It's all about the rules of bowling, that movie. There's an Amish guy in it. I think he's supposed to be a little kid, but it's Randy Quaid in his 50s. Dingus, you didn't see Kingpin? I'm really the only Kingpin viewer on the podcast.
You are the only Kingpin viewer.
Wow. That feels good. All right, never mind. That's my.
But I
now
watched.
I've ruined Kingpin for you guys. I feel bad.
I appreciate you doing that because I watched Osmosis Jones this week and I've had my fill of Farrelly Brothers.
Wow. I think it's what's your number two?
All right, my number two. Okay, so I'm shifting gears here. We're talking about subverting expectations. This is not a positive subversion of expectations. This is from the movie Munich. Did you see the movie Munich?
Yeah.
Yeah, I saw it right before Kingpin.
That's a great double feature.
Yeah, it is.
All right, well, it's the famous sex montage at the end, which is this weird, bizarre...
I hate that part. I hate that scene.
It's horrible. It's this. He's having this flashback or this sort of, I don't know, an emotional epiphany about what happened to the hostages at the Munich Olympics. And while he's having this epiphany, he's having sex with his wife. And Spielberg intercuts. He's sort of spent the whole film not showing this, and he intercuts what actually happened to the hostages with the sex scene. And it is a total subversion, I think, of that, what that moment should be, of the dawning epiphany of what actually happened, or the character realizing what actually happened, or of even a sex scene. It makes absolutely no sense to me, and it is a complete subversion of what I expected to happen at the end of that movie.
It's also, yeah, because it makes no sense, because there's no reason he would know these things.
Right.
He's not there.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
That's what they did in Jaws the Revenge, which is ironic because Spielberg directed Munich, but not Jaws the
Revenge. Nice.
But, like, Ellen Brody has these flashbacks to, like, scenes on the boat from the first movie, even though she wasn't there.
While she's having sex?
No, but she's masturbating.
Whoa.
Well, Spielberg does that. I mean, Saving Private Ryan is a flashback of a character who was not there for any of that stuff. So,
well, yeah,
oh, that's right.
Misdirection. that's a subversion of audience expectations.
That Spielberg guy is brilliant.
Yeah.
But I was just going with a specific scene, and it's that awful sex scene at the end of Munich.
Well, there's something about that scene, though, Dingus. It's realistic, because that's one way to prevent ejaculating too early. You think of an atrocity.
Oh, my God!
It's true. Like, an atrocity against the Jews specifically can prevent that. So
wait, the old man didn't masturbate at the tombstone. Is that what you're saying happened in Saving Private Ryan?
No, I went back to Munich. I'm talking about...
Oh! Now I get it. That was very confusing.
Well, let's move on to my number two. Are we ready?
I am.
Hope no one hears this.
Extricate myself from this.
God.
So my number two, again, Kelly Wan, thanks for screwing up my list, because it's a death. There's a brilliant director, and he's got a new movie coming out this month. It opens, I think, limited opening December 30th, so I presume it's one of those, like, limited releases where they want to be eligible for the Academy Awards. It's a movie called White Ribbon, and the director is Michael Haneke.
Funny Games guy.
Yeah, so in Funny Games is, in a way, this conventional, criminals terrorize a family, family fights back kind of crime drama thing. And it's Funny Games is really meta, and it's full of subverting expectations. And this begins with the killing of a child in front of the child's mother. And what really screws up your expectations there, and what makes this one of the most difficult movies to watch I've ever seen, is that he doesn't cut. You know, the child gets shot, and you can see the feet sticking out from behind a couch, and there's blood on the wall, and there's his mother standing there reacting for this five-minute take where the camera does not cut, and it doesn't shift, and there's no editing, and this actress is just doing an amazing job, and it's just incredibly uncomfortable, and it reminds you, okay, well, this is why and where you normally cut, or you sort of work your way around it, or you do something sort of anodyne and sanitized to get around that awful shock. And Michael Haneke, he's a brilliant director, and he's all about subverting.
Yeah. I was going to say, if you've seen Funny Games, that moment wouldn't subvert your expectations. You'd be expecting a kid to die in the first 5 minutes.
But if you've seen Funny Games, then you've seen Funny Games.
Right.
Well, but also there are things similar. Well, I mean, you think of Cash. Cash? Cachet? No, I'm confusing myself. Cachet. No, it's Cash. Dingus, shut up.
It's Tango and Cachet.
And even that one of the less successful ones he did called Code Red. Oh, or Piano Teacher. Just full of like grueling moments like that. He's this unflinching director, and I just specifically go back to that moment in Funny Games, which is the first movie, this first Michael Haneke movie I'd ever seen. So I'm looking forward to White Ribbon.
Wait, that scene you're describing is in White Ribbon.
It's in Funny Games. So because I'm a fan of Haneke, I'm looking forward to White Ribbon, which
All right.
I thought you said that it was from White Ribbon.
Wait, why?
He's doing it in two movies?
That's why you said, oh, I'm sorry. So I was very unclear. I just parenthetically was mentioning that I'm looking forward to White Ribbon coming out, but the scene I was talking about was in Funny Games. And when you said Funny Games, Kelly, I took that to mean you knew that I was talking about Funny Games. So that's what you get for interrupting. You screwed me up.
Well, I'm curious. So this scene that you're talking about in Funny Games, the one that you just described, it seems unbearable to me, but you like this guy as a director and you're looking forward to his next film.
Michael Haneke is the point of Funny Games is how so you haven't seen it, Dingus?
I have not seen Funny Games. Oh. I think you tried to scare
Tom,
me.
You're
away
wrong.
From it.
Yeah, you wouldn't like it. The kid doesn't get shot on screen. The guy's making a sandwich, and you hear it happen.
Right, but then you cut to the room. I mean, the kid has been shot of his mother. Then you cut to the room, and you see his feet sticking out from behind a couch, and there's blood on the wall. He does the same thing with Naomi Watts and Tim Roth in the American remake,
right?
Which I didn't think was as good, primarily because I'd already seen Funny Games. It was one of those weird sort of almost shot-for-shot remakes.
Gus Van Sant's going to remake the American version.
I can't wait.
I mean, of course, I loved Cash, but I'm really leery of something like Funny Games. And from the way the reason I'm asking this is not because I'm trying to show umbrage. It's just that it sounds like from what you're describing is this a chore – not a chore, just brutal to sit through.
It's brutal to sit through and – where the movie ends up, it's one of those movies where you don't really know what's going on until the final scene, and what's going on isn't necessarily what you think you've seen. Kelly, how would you sort of couch what I'm trying to say? You've seen Funny Games. Like, you know how it ends up.
I would say it ends about the way you think it's going to end, actually.
Well, there's a lot of meta commentary in Funny Games. Funny
right.
Games is as much about you as the viewer watching this as it is about the characters on screen.
It's Hostel meets Blair Witch 2, Book of Shadows.
You don't agree with any of that. See, I think those I think those are horror movies. I don't think Funny Games is necessarily
no.
a movie
it's,
as a sort of an
It's like a science experiment. It's like a German doctor experimenting.
Yeah. It's an implication of the audience. It's sort of a
Tanik asking, is it safe? Well, he drills into your nerve.
Okay. I'd go with that.
Which isn't Dingus's idea of fun, and it's most people's not idea. It's worth seeing once if you're not Dingus.
Well, it's a lot about, I mean, it's about filmmaking. It's about the experience of watching a movie.
Right.
And that's interesting.
And the acting's really good, and it's shot well.
No, yeah. Haneke's brilliant.
It's just a little repetitive, I think, maybe. And the fact that he rigs, you know, he stacks the deck, and he makes a joke. The joke is that he's stacking the deck. And then after a while, you go, well, I know the deck's stacked, so I know how this is going to land one way.
And it's kind of hard to talk about without just completely giving away what he's trying to do.
All right.
So suffice to say, Dingus, I don't think you necessarily need to see it, but it's a fascinating experiment. I think it's very well done. And that scene in particular was just like, whoa, you can't do this. You're not supposed to be doing this scene this way. Go ahead.
Does it matter whether you watch the – because he did both
the German
American.
Yeah, watch the German one. I mean, I just – yeah. Yeah. I think there's something, too, about it being in a different language that almost – I don't know if it makes it tougher to watch it. You know, it almost is like a little layer of insulation.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. It must distance you somewhat.
Well, it's that same – it's also, Dingus, that celebrity factor. Watching Michael Pitt, Tim Roth, and Naomi Watts, you know, I'm watching actors that I know and I've seen in other stuff, and it's not quite the same.
It also taps into your fear of Germans. our universal fear of them, including the German universal fear.
Does it deal with San Diego or Terry Hatcher?
What is your number one movie that subverted expectations, Kelly Wand?
Well, I'll tell you, Tom. I was gonna go with
You're gonna do two number ones. You can't give an also ran.
Don't say Psycho.
Okay, all right. I won't say Last American Virgin. I will say what my number one actually is, which is Rocky IV.
Where Dolph Lundgren wins?
Yeah. No, but see, that's the thing. I couldn't believe when I was seeing it that it was going to be the exact same movie as Rocky III, so I was really surprised. So Rocky IV.
You just did your Kingpin thing all over again, though, didn't you?
Where no, because in that one, the bad guy wins. But I thought in Rocky IV, I go, well, there's got to be some twist. Like,
wait, who wins in Rocky IV?
Rocky IV does.
Oh, Sylvester Stallone wins, and you thought he was going to lose.
Yeah, or something. His coach dies. Here's what in Rocky III, his coach dies, he loses a fight, and then he wins a fight at the end, and then he makes a dumb speech. And then in Rocky IV, he loses a fight, his coach dies, and he wins at the end. And he makes a dumb
which
and
is...
I couldn't believe it was like two. I don't know. It's just so weird that it was the exact same thing.
Which is the one where he goes to Afghanistan and fights the Russians?
That's the third Rambo, the one that's never on cable.
Oh, okay.
How often I surf for it. It's never on. It's the Lost Rambo episode.
And that's your number one? A Rocky movie?
No, I'm just kidding. It's Last American Virgin.
I sense some revisionism going on here. What is Last American Virgin, by the way? I'm thinking of 40-year-old Virgin. Obviously, that's not that.
It's a teen movie. It came out in the wake of Fast Times, Ridgemont High, except I think it's 86. But the subversion is that the dopey protagonist doesn't get the girl. She goes off with the cool guy. Ha ha!
Kelly Wand, have you accidentally done movies that you only like because of the scene at the end?
No, that's a subversion. That counts as a subversion. Okay. And a non-death one, too, which makes it worth 2 points.
Fair enough. You've done four, though. This is now four by two.
So this time I only did four, so I don't want to trim it down. Rough cut.
You also, your list was full of movies I haven't seen. I don't quite know what to make of it.
You guys didn't see Kingpin? That's so
weird. I haven't seen Great Waldo Pepper, Kingpin, Rocky IV, or Last American Virgin.
But you've seen all these obscure French horror movies.
Right.
That no one's seen and no one's going to see.
Right.
All right.
Somebody's got to watch them.
No, I know. I don't know. I thought everyone saw Kingpin by accident, even. Just like,
just like surfing cable.
I don't know. 5 seconds. Oh. Because it's about sports. You didn't see it. You didn't think the idea of Woody Harrelson with the big rubber hand.
No, because it doesn't do much for. And it's a Farrelly Brothers movie about sports. I mean, that's a deadly combination right there.
Well, Dumb and Dumber's about skiing. So.
Okay.
Did you see that one?
I did. Yes.
Uh huh. Farrelly's apologist. Did you like Dumb and Dumber, or am I over?
No, not really. I thought it was okay. It had its moments.
Tough room.
Yeah, sorry.
What to you is the funniest movie ever made?
Funniest movie ever made would probably be Chupacabra Terror. There you go. All right, so that's your number. Those are your number ones.
Yeah, those are all my number ones for now.
Okay.
You know what? I'm suspicious of anybody who has a number one funniest movie.
You got me. I'm suspicious of anyone who wants to do more than one podcast a week.
Yeah, I'm suspicious of us as well. Luckily, I like being suspicious.
The devil's handmaid.
Dingus, what is your number one movie scene that subverted expectations?
All right, my number one movie scene that subverted my expectations. I'm gonna lay down a quote for you guys, and right. I'm gonna see if you can guess.
I'll be able to get it. I'm good at this.
Yeah, I know you're gonna be able to get it. All right, here we go. You ready, guys?
Yep.
Here we go. I'm looking at your face and I just want to smash it. I just want to fucking smash it with a sledgehammer and squeeze it. You're so pretty.
Oh. See, I know what it is. Kelly Wand, do you know?
Let me do another line.
Wait, does that do anything for you, Kelly? Because that to me right there, I just love that scene.
Miller's Crossing.
Give him more, Dingus.
I want to chew your face, and I want to scoop out your eyes, and I want to eat them, chew them, and suck on them.
Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid.
Colder. Cold.
I haven't seen it.
Oh, Kelly.
You have seen it. Let's give him more lines.
The last line in the scene is, okay, this is funny, this is nice. But that's all I'm going to give you.
California Suite.
I was going to give him lines from other parts of the movie.
Give me an easy one.
Do you want to give him another line?
I like this game. Let's just do this for an hour and a half.
Why are you wearing a suit?
Malcolm X.
Thing is, you give him a line.
Is Kari Burr in this movie?
That's something else.
That's a terrible line, Dingus. Don't give him an inside joke line. Give him a real
one. I can't help it.
Hangar 18.
There's a piano in your driveway.
I beat up the bathroom at the restaurant.
Nice. I have to renew my gym membership.
Burn after reading.
How many sisters do you have?
Stay
seven.
Hungry.
I have seven sisters.
Sweet 16 candles.
Kelly Wand, please, please, please do not tell me that you have not seen Punch Drunk Love.
I haven't seen it. Adam Sandler? Uh-huh. So I was too busy seeing Kingpin that night.
All right, so, Dingus's lines were the... go ahead, Dingus, sorry.
So, go ahead, Tom, what were you going to say?
I was going to explain your choice, which which would mean we don't need you here, so...
I don't think we do need me here. No, okay. It's the love scene between the two main characters in Punch Drunk Love, and they meet in Hawaii. And Kelly, you got to see this movie. It's just unbelievably beautiful, and I think you would totally get it. And it's not for everybody. I saw it with four people, and I left the movie feeling like I don't know. I'd been injected with something amazing. I left the movie feeling like I was walking on clouds, and the other three people were looking at me like, yeah, that what? Either they hated it or they were tepid. And that movie made me feel great. And this scene is the embodiment of that. And it's not at all what you expect. There's this tender, loving moment. This is the first time the characters are in this tender bedroom situation. It's at the beginning of a sex scene, and
that
this
would
is
speak
the,
to me.
And well, this is the dialogue between them. They're saying they want to smash each other's faces, and you watch it, and you realize you're just it's perfect, but it's totally subversive for what somebody's love scene or sex scene should be.
Who's the girl?
Emily Watson. Watson.
And it's Carey Mulligan.
And it's Adam Sandler just does a bang up job. He's amazing in the movie. Kelly Wand, are you not a P.T. Anderson fan? Like, does that?
I'm hit and miss with him, but he's like the Star Trek movies where every other one's good.
I mean, they're all. I mean, he's got this sort of Coen Brothers thing where they all have their own distinct quality. I mean, there's certainly similarities, but I just. I don't think you can call yourself a P.T. He's only done, four movies? I mean, you can't call yourself a P.T. Anderson fan unless you've seen all of them. What's the matter with you?
Well, I'm not calling myself one. But that's the only one I haven't seen, so I should see it. Because it's probably better than Magnolia, which...
Certainly, the difference between that and Magnolia is it's much more focused. Like after, Lucky 8, or not Lucky 8, what the heck is the... Hard 8? What the hell?
Hard 8, yeah.
Yeah, I like that one.
And that's more focused, and it's about it. You know, it's very clearly okay. A couple of characters. Here's their interaction, and this is even more than that, and even more so than There Will Be Blood. I mean, this is just like one guy, pretty much, and his relationship. It's just so in a character's head, and it's like Dingus was saying. It's just an intoxicating place to be.
But it's the guy from Eight Crazy Nights.
But you know what? It's really not. I mean, I don't know where Adam Sandler drew this performance from, but I mean he's obviously a guy with some substance, and there's a lot of gravity in the performance, and I never would have guessed that would be the case with an Adam Sandler performance. It's like I don't want to say Robin Williams because that's just a terrible example, but it's like you sort of get used to seeing one character a certain way, and then when you really see something underneath all that, it's just amazing. And I've seen Robin Williams sort of touch on some of that a couple of times where he drops the crazy act and you're like, oh, this guy could be a great actor. So that's...
It's Spanglish.
Yeah. It is like he's been given permission to take a vacation from himself. Yeah. It's like P.T. Anderson said, you don't have to be Adam Sandler in this. This is the character. You don't have to worry about anything. Like, he hypnotized him. It's an amazing performance.
So you're attributing it to some kind of magic or voodoo.
Okay. Yeah, I think he was actually animated. I think it's a stop motion performance.
Very good. All right, well, my number one scene that subverts expectations, and I just want to tell you guys the scene because I love this scene. Nobody dies in this one. And I want to describe it, and don't blurt out what the movie is, Kelly Wand. So I just want to talk about the scene. I want to describe it. So you know in the detective movies, a guy gets a phone call, and he's like, yeah, right. And he takes out a pad of paper, and he writes on the pad of paper. And there's obviously some vital information he's just gotten. And the protagonist sees him get this phone call. But he rips the piece of paper off the pad, he folds it up, and he puts it in his pocket, and he walks out of the room. And the protagonist is like, God, I got to know what's on the piece of paper. So he goes over to the pad, and he takes a pencil, and he shades the page underneath it. And he can see the phone number or the address, and he knows where to go. He's outsmarted the bad guy. So in this movie, Ben Gazzara, he's somehow wrapped up in this mystery. He takes the phone call, and Ben Gazzara, I love that guy. He's in awesome sort of villain, or there's something not right about him. So he takes the phone call. He's kind of like a Hugh Hefner character in this one. And he says, yeah. And he writes on the piece of paper, tears the piece of paper off, and he says to the hero, I got to go. I got to take care of something. Puts the paper in his pocket and walks out. So Jeff Bridges in Big Lebowski goes over the pad of paper with the pencil, and he does the, he's smart. I mean, he's like, oh, I got an idea. I know what to do here. And he takes the pencil and he rubs it over, and it's a stick figure with a big old dick sticking out of it. It means nothing. Ben Gazzara took the phone call and doodled a stick figure with a dick sticking out of it, and the look on Jeff Bridges' face. And the Coen brothers know that you think he's going to discover an address or a phone number, and just the look on his face as he sees that doodle that Ben Gazzara has drawn that means absolutely nothing. But then Ben Gazzara comes back into the room, so he has to quickly, you know, take off the piece of paper that he just made and fold it up, put it in his pocket. And the Coen brothers don't stop there in terms of playing with this little gag, because Jeff Bridges is about to get arrested by the Malibu police. Drugged out of his skull, running down the road, no idea what's going on. And it cuts to a shot of him in the police station and the cops examining the contents of his pocket, staring disapprovingly at a weird drawing of a stick figure with a big old dick. I just love that the Coen brothers take that one little expectation of what a movie normally does, and they spin it out into this just beautiful little joke, and they play with it. And what makes it so funny is there's no phone number, there's no address, it's just Ben Gazzara with a profane doodle. So that's my number one pick, and that's actually what made me think of this week's 3x3. I just love that scene so much.
But it's doubly good. It's great. What a great choice. Because the whole reason Jeff Bridges knows to do that is probably from watching movies. So exactly. His expectation is subverted as well.
Yes.
Right. Nice.
Yeah. So.
Well, when I saw it, I thought, oh, that doodle dick's going to become part of the plot somehow. Like,
and it doesn't. Like
the icon for the female strip club or something.
Well, Big Lebowski, too, is just so – it's so subversive of the genre in general. You know, it really is this idea of what if you took this awesome film noir story and just dropped a stoner as the lead character into it, you know, what would happen? You know, it's basically Maltese Falcon missing Humphrey Bogart.
Well, it's the Big Sleep.
Big Sleep. Yeah, one of those Dashiell Hammett things.
Oh my god.
Uh-huh. You guys are novel nerds.
We are such
risky.
Yeah, reading Chandler. Boo. He reads Raymond Chandler.
All right, so that's this week's Kaliwan. What do you got for us next week?
Oh yeah. I forgot. All right, do I have to explain what a 3x3 is? Or can I
Hopefully the audience knows by now. After.
Yeah, it's us doing three lists of three things with threes. Or something. I think that sums it all up, doesn't it, Tom? Did I skip anything?
You just have to tell us what it is, or we're not going to know what movies to pick.
Oh. All right, well, this is a little cannibalized from there's a book called 10 Bad Dates with De Niro by this guy named Richard T. Kelly, and it's kind of a bunch of lists of stuff that we're doing, sort of.
Is it even though Richard Kelly or a different Richard Kelly? Richard Kelly of the box fame?
No.
Oh, good. Okay.
He's got a T as his middle initial, so it can't be him.
That should have tipped me off. Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, but his lists are 10, so in a way he's ahead of us in a lot of ways because we're only doing threes. But
yeah, we're not ready
like
for that.
10 bad dates with De Niro, 10 different dates and 10 different De Niro movies. Anyway, so this is sort of he had one with 10 best uses of a head, a decapitated head or something.
Nice.
So
is that what we get to do?
No. Ah. We get to do – I improved on that.
Okay.
For ours. Because this is a podcast, it's three best uses of an amputated limb, including heads and or dicks.
Okay, Dingus, you cannot steal. I know Dingus is going to try to steal one of mine. I'm calling dibs on the one that you're thinking of right now, Dingus. Don't even think about it. So, okay, so amputated limbs, digits, even just like fingers, like
right.
Any extremity, any amputated.
Nose.
Okay, no heads, though?
No, heads count.
Heads count. Okay.
Heads and penises both count. Butt cheeks count. Fingernails don't count. Teeth, a little iffy. Ears count. So Kirk
Let's
Douglas
just go with the, like limbs or extremities. Can we say that? Does that work?
Well, is head an extremity?
Not really. Limbs, extremities, or heads?
Yeah, limbs, extremities, and heads.
I love that movie.
It's my favorite Guy Ritchie. but yeah. That's my stupid list, and it's way better than the one I came up with before that.
That's good. No. I think these are all good. I mean, I'm liking these. Dingus, do you know what I think that you're thinking of?
No.
Good. You better not be thinking of it. When you think of it, I call dibs.
I was going to give examples, but then I went, oh, I might use these.
Well, what I did with my examples is I wanted to sort of preempt the obvious ones that I knew you guys would think of. Hence the Deep Blue Sea and Indiana Jones thing.
Well, the Deep Blue Sea kind of happened organically, so that's fine.
Right.
Deep Blue Sea has amputated limbs in it and could go on this list.
But there's so much. I mean, that's so pedestrian. Surely you can think of better things than any amputated limb in Deep Blue Sea. I think
right, that would be like choosing Janet Leigh for this week's 3x3.
Or Rocky IV.
Good point. Okay.
All right. I like this list, Kelly Wand. This is a fun one. So join us next week. And we will also be back to see to discuss A Single Man, directed by Tom Ford with Colin Firth and Julianne Moore. So I am Tom Chick, and with me tonight we have Christian Mintask.
Christian Morosky. Goodbye, everybody.
And Kelly Wand, say goodnight to all your fans.
Yeah, see you. Sorry.